Welcome to the Journalism of Everything podcast. I am your host, Doree Smith, a freelance journalist bringing you curiosity, research, and expert interviews with thoughtfulness. The easiest thing you can do is stay informed. Enjoy the episode. Daniel Penny, 24, was a veteran Marine taking his daily commute, coming home from classes in architecture at the New York City College of Technology. He was on the subway, the F train, when at the 2nd Avenue stop, 30-year-old Jordan Neely jumped onto the car and started screaming threats to the men, women, and children there. Neely was a street performer known for his Michael Jackson impersonations, who had also struggled with homelessness and mental illness. He had a tragic upbringing, having watched his mother get bludgeoned to death when he was a teenager. According to Penny and others on the train, Neely was saying things like, "I'm going to kill you. I'm willing to go to jail for life. And I'm willing to die." According to witness interviews and from Penny's recounting himself, Penny jumped up, brought Neely to the ground, and put him in a chokehold to restrain him. Neely fought the hold for several minutes until he finally went limp. Penny insists that he was not trying to kill Neely, and he was looking for his chest to be moving up and down, and had loosened his chokehold, which he had learned to do during his training as a Marine. It took several minutes for police to arrive to help Daniel Penny, and by the time they arrived, Neely was limp and unconscious. Neely was declared dead later at the hospital, and Penny was charged with murder, but later he was acquitted on December 9th, 2024. There are loads of details to this case. For how long did he apply the chokehold? Was this racially motivated? Did Neely actually say that he was going to kill people during his tirade? Penny has obviously been criticized for his action and charged, but everyone on the subway car defended him, saying he did the right thing. Does this matter? On one hand, Daniel Penny was trying to defend himself and others from what he calculated to be a significant threat. On the other hand, he executed a man who was exhibiting signs of a mental illness and did not have a weapon. Should private citizens ever have the power to enact justice? When the smoldering Luigi Mangione walked up behind UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson on December 4th, 2024, in front of the New York Hilton Midtown, he carefully raised a 3D printed pistol and silencer and shot him in the back, killing him. The expected reaction from the country was outrage and shock. Instead, people celebrated the death of a man who was symbolic of corporate greed. According to a Harris poll in 2023, 70% of Americans believed the healthcare system was failing them. UnitedHealthcare was known to be a prolific denier of medical insurance claims, directly impacting millions of its customers. I was shocked at the social media celebrations of this execution, but people are really angry and frustrated at how expensive healthcare is and how profits are the priority of insurance companies. This kind of reaction brings up the question, was Mangione a calculating murderer or a hero of the people? And even if Mangione is considered a hero of the people, do his actions belong in a strong democracy? I interviewed Professor John Michaels of the UCLA School of Law about vigilante justice. Professor Michaels specializes in constitutional and national security law. He has a BA in English literature and political science from Williams College, a BA and an MA from the University of Oxford, and a Juris Doctorate from Yale Law School. He clerked for Supreme Court Justice David Souter. His academic scholarship has appeared in the Yale Law Journal, University of Chicago Law Review, and Harvard Law Review, and he has written popular essays for the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Foreign Affairs, and The Guardian. He has written two books. One is Constitutional Coup, Privatization's Threat to the American Republic, published by the Harvard University Press in 2017, and Vigilante Nation, published by Simon & Schuster, and co-written with David Knoll, professor of law at Rutgers University. Our discussion about vigilante justice really evolved into a discussion of how the government can encourage vigilante justice to further its political goals and how important a strong democracy is to our well-being and an enjoyable way of life. All right, so I'll get started. I just want to do a quick intro of you, but I think you probably could do the better introduction. Just tell me a little bit about who you are, and you obviously have a lot of academic and legal experience, if you could do that.
Sure, I'm John Michaels. I'm a professor at UCLA School of Law. I teach a bunch of public law classes, constitutional law, administrative law, and national security law. And for the last several years, I've been intensively researching the rise of democratic illiberalism and political violence in the United States.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah, you actually just wrote, I know you have a couple of books out, but you just wrote with David Knoll, Vigilante Nation, right?
Yes.
I guess tell me real quick just about your first book, about the constitutional coup, and then your most recent one.
Yeah, so in the mid-2010s, I was working fairly closely on questions of the challenges to the federal bureaucracy and where and how it was being undermined. And in retrospect now, I think the book came out maybe 10 years too soon or 8 years too soon, because it was harder than to get people, I think, focused on the ways in which the, especially on the right, there was a real effort to delegitimize, disempower career government experts. Today, of course, that's coming back into vogue in with much greater potency. I could kind of be like, yeah, I've been talking about this for 8 to 10 years. The book's upside, to the extent it could be characterized as an upside, is essentially that the debasement of a federal civil service raises serious constitutional challenges of the sort that I think is now becoming increasingly clear to folks who are paying attention to what Donald Trump and Elon Musk are endeavoring to do across all the federal agencies.
Yeah, it's I could probably interview you for about 10 hours on what's going on now. So that's good.
Good.
Now, so tell me, so let me tell you kind of where I'm coming from with this episode. When Luigi Mangione, obviously accused of executing the UnitedHealthcare CEO, when that happened on social media, people were cheering, were and still are, I think, to some
Yes.
extent, just wow, good job, that sort of thing. And it made me think about whether these kinds of vigilante acts would belong in a democracy. Now, your research is really interesting because you're talking about in the book Vigilante Nation, you're basically asserting that in the history of our nation, there's been a lot of state-sponsored vigilante, or at least encouraging that, particularly by white Christian nationalists, but you can correct me if there's other. So, kind of tell me about, I mean, this has happened even from the early days of our democracy. So if you don't mind telling me a little bit about some of those instances.
Yeah, so we focus on the political project of vigilantism as being essentially interrelated and coextensive with state power. And so our focus historically is on the use of kind of private violence in furtherance of state-supported slavery, obviously, state-supported segregation. And what became really, really interesting and very troubling to us is the practice pretty much died out with the civil rights movement. That the idea that governments would support politically violent projects fell by the wayside. And so during the kind of modern era from the 1960s forward, to the extent there were acts of vigilantism, they were done what lawyers call ultra vires, outside of the scope of the law. There was no one that they really could turn to for support. Maybe there'd be kind of some popular elements that would cheer them on. And so that's when, like in pop culture, you see the rise of these kind of lone, angry figures who take the law into their own hands. Often in like urban settings, like Death Wish, and then in the 2000s with the popular TV show 24, Jack Bauer, who's Kiefer Sutherland, would always be kind of on the edge of what's lawful. And it seems like in every season there was a point where he would turn in his badge and go after the bad guys the way he thought he should because the state was restricting him. It was identified as an external project. And then what we're seeing more recently is states supporting acts of private violence. And at the time of the writing, and I think still to this day, it's almost exclusively been right-wing government supporting right-wing forms of violence. That said, there are other instances, and that's an interesting line to pursue. Okay, so obviously Mangione came out. What he allegedly did happened after the publication of the book, But one way to, so the two ways we could be looking at this. One is just looking at kind of the public support, enthusiasm. I mean, there's a lot we could talk about, the kind of sexualization of him because he's a good-looking guy and people thinking he's kind of dreamy. And does that like make him an attractive revolutionary, or does it give him longer leave to be acting outside of the scope of the law and society and morality and everything else, right? To date, that has not been a state-supported project. So it what one would hope would happen, and I expect will happen, is that he's prosecuted and convicted. If we see a jury nullify the evidence, essentially say, no, he's the embodiment of a spirit that we want to embrace and let him go. Or if we see a governor pardon him, like the way Governor Greg Adams pardoned violent attackers of who are convicted of murder in Austin, Texas, well, then we start seeing more of a parallel, and we would see a version of or a spreading of state-sponsored political violence leaving the extremes of our society and entering either into left spaces or mainstream spaces. Mangione is interesting because he seems to have enthusiasts across the political spectrum, and which speaks to a kind of a different moment from ones that I think that our other kind of large data points, which have been very much focused on kind of black-white issues, issues of folks who are defined and understood to be kind of historically discriminated minorities, so transgender folks, gay people. That type of discrimination tends to track a kind of political, a partisan project, and Mangione doesn't. So that's why he's fascinating and also really scary to me as someone who studied this and saying, oh, could this spread?
I mean, I wonder if what he did is he just going to be excused as, well, he's a little off, probably has some mental health issues from some things that I've read. Or is there going to be any action, impetus for action? Because obviously people are upset that about the healthcare system and how it is, or a lot of people are. So I guess in any way, can vigilantism lead to change, or is it usually kind of like he seems to be a rogue, right? I mean, doesn't seem to be any evidence that anyone put him up to this so far.
Well, one lesson from vigilantism, a hard lesson to learn, but a good one, is again the one kind of we learned during the 1960s and 1970s, which is we can't tolerate a society in which people take the law into their own hands. We have this is not the Wild Wild West. There are police officers available. There are criminal justice systems in place. You don't have to lynch someone to a tree because it would take, you know, 3 weeks for whatever the circuit judge to ride through some little frontier town, right? I'm not excusing, but I understand that form of kind of popular justice, is it, if you want to call it justice. But we don't need that today. We don't have to have that today. So the claims for why that would be the case, why someone would ever need to take the law into their own hand, is it's a much harder burden of necessity. And so then we're really stuck with questions of was this taken in self-defense? And obviously, in the Mangione case, I don't think that can be credibly claimed. If we were to look at the recent New York City subway case, where
Daniel Penny.
self-defense, Daniel Penny's case, right? Then it becomes kind of a bit of a Rorschach test of like what is fear, what is danger in a society? Did the man who was killed present a danger warranting Penny's reaction? Okay. Did the protesters that Kyle Rittenhouse shot in Kenosha, Wisconsin, constitute an actual threat to Rittenhouse and those around him? And then we have debates about, well, what does that mean? And are we becoming a more brittle, fragile society where what we take to be a threat to us is treated as, rather than something that's discomforting, something that warrants and maybe frustrating and maybe warrants some degree of restraint or reaction that warrants a lethal response of the sort that Penny and Rittenhouse resorted to. And then we can have a longer conversation about how gun laws, gun rights, self-defense standards have been changing over the last, again, 20 years or so, when we went from a society that said, oh, wow, now we have regular police forces everywhere. Now we have a fully fleshed out criminal justice system. We don't have to go to war with our neighbors, to now sort of wanting that option, notwithstanding the police. So we go away from doctrines of criminal defense where there were duties to retreat to so-called stand your ground doctrines, where you don't have to step back from violence. And in Kyle Rittenhouse's case, he crossed state lines looking for trouble.
He did. But he
And
now
so
he was acquitted, correct? I
also
can't
was acquitted.
remember.
Yes.
He was
Like
acquitted.
Penny, he was acquitted. Like the
That's right.
man in Texas, unlike the man in Texas who was convicted by a jury, there we had a case of a state level pardon.
Oh, right. Okay. There's a lot, because there's self, like Daniel Penny, he was saying self-defense and I'm protecting the people on the subway. I wonder how much with that case, just being on a subway, not having, I mean, he had police eventually available to him, but it was several minutes,
Right.
before he was able to get off. But then, yeah, then Kyle Rittenhouse basically going to look for, like you said, kind of action or
Action. Yeah,
action.
responding to a call to like let's preserve the integrity or quality of our city, and he wasn't even part of that city, as it were. And it really seemed to fall on racial lines there, that the protesters were, if they weren't themselves predominantly black, the cause was focused on kind of black race, racial justice. I just
Definitely.
want to circle back to one of the other kind
Yeah,
of
sure.
par like the kind of paradigm vigilante cases in modern times also took place on the subway, which was Bernard Goetz in the mid 1980s in New York. And maybe some of your older listeners remember that case. I grew up in New York. I was just a kid at the time, but I remember it being all over the news. And in that case, Bernard Goetz, who is a mousy a young man who had been mugged before and was carrying a weapon, was aggressively approached by five kids who were harassing him, happened to be black, and he shot them. And some of the tabloid papers, like the New York Post and the Daily News, was like did some flirtation with celebrating him at a time where, unlike again today, where Los sorry, New York was a more dangerous place than it is now, right? So there were these understandings that the city was, somewhat had fallen from its state of civility. And there was this kind of pushback. But Goetz got no political support.
Oh,
No
really?
politicians rushed to his defense.
Oh,
And he
interesting.
was convicted and he served his time. And then he tried to kind of launch something of a political career afterwards and got absolutely nowhere. And so I would contrast him with someone where there, I think, if anyone, like, I think he, Penny, who's a strapping Marine in a very different context, doesn't look like that he needed to go as far as he did, in light of, at least if Bernard Goetz is our benchmark
Right, yeah.
of what one would do in that space. But you know, and we don't, and we don't know what's going to happen with someone like Daniel Penney. We don't know what his interest, where his interests lie, but we do know that Kyle Rittenhouse has carved out something of a political or political adjacent type of influencer career
Yeah.
as someone who has products he's endorsing and is a speaker at like right-wing political organizations and things like that. So if you want to start looking at like public recognition, public endorsement, or acceptance,
Yeah,
one way to
yeah.
look at it is like, well, what happens if a jury does acquit?
Right, yeah.
Are they treated as is that treated as like a gross mistake, or is it treated as a vindication of rights?
Right. And it really could, gosh, the considerations for that are interesting. Just being, what's the time period? What's going on? What's, like with Kyle Rittenhouse, there's a huge amount of people that, are kind of in that mindset, I think. I've seen him on some, I had my previous episode was about immigration and like immigration, what's going on now with the ICE, raids and that sort of thing. And so he's been on lots of things like that, like people who patrol the border on their own, trying to get people to go back or apprehend them and help CBP or anything. So yeah, there's a huge audience for him. Daniel Penney, I don't know what he'll, what his aspirations are kind of be. He seems to have kind of tried to just fade right
Yeah.
now after everything,
Yeah. And he, you know, it's also, he's in a very blue community in a blue state. And
That's
so
true.
the kind of the universe in which he's inhabiting may be very different from a lot of the vigilante types that David Noel and I were studying, because most of the, well, all of the state endorsements of vigilante actions of various sorts that we can get into pretty much are concentrated in deep red states where governors and legislators were looking to kind of mobilize a universe of already pretty agitated and angry culture warriors to advance various interests and causes, either in furtherance of exactly what the state wants to do or going beyond what the state has the capacity to do.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
And
one, sorry, go ahead.
please.
I was gonna say one example is Texas, what is it, SB8,
Sure.
the abortion ban. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, you're more educated on this than I am for sure. That basically is not only the ban past 6 weeks, but also it incentivizes people to turn healthcare providers in, is that right? Or is there more to it than
Yeah.
that?
So the SB8 allows a private right of action to sue medical providers or anyone else who supports a person's termination of a pregnancy. So that includes Uber drivers,
Jeez.
employers who know that one of their workers, like she's going in for an abortion. This predates the change in the constitutional protections
Okay.
of
Oh, I didn't realize that.
abortion. So this was designed in as half a workaround because the state couldn't limit abortions at that point. Ah, but private people could sue doctors and basically threaten them with bankruptcy so that they essentially shut down their abortion clinics. And that's
Oh.
what happened. So basically overnight, Texas providers stopped offering abortion services. And then the Supreme Court changes the changes their constitutional understanding of privacy rights and reproductive rights. And
Yeah.
but we still have SB8 on the books. And then one question is, well, why do you still have SB8 on the books when it's unlawful for doctors to provide abortions? And one of the reasons is you might think that the government can't crack down on all instances. But now you have a universe of people, annoyed neighbors, annoyed colleagues, someone in HR in the hospital who has nothing, has no political project, but has a kind of like a labor grievance, who's like, well, I'm going to screw my bosses and I'm going to rat them out, right? You have no idea what could motivate that type of pettiness and anger beyond that. And in places like Austin and San Antonio, that are blue pockets within red states, their district attorneys had already said, well, we're not going to prosecute anyone under now that Roe v. Wade has been kind of wiped from the history books. We're not going to do anything. So that in another context, that would suggest that that's a sanctuary. Because as long as the government is the only legal force in town, that means San Antonio safe or Austin safe until they were or Houston until they replace the district attorney. But with SB8, anyone can anyone has essentially the same stature as a district attorney. Now they can't put them in prison, but they could bankrupt them. So that's why that's such a potent device and such a one that's a game changer that invites the type of neighbor to neighbor, colleague to colleague animosity that could re that really threatens to further tear the fabric of our society. I'll give you just another example that's not grounded in law, but it's tragic and it's just was reported last week. So there's been a lot of stories since January 20th about enthusiasm for mass deportations and about calling up and saying, you know, hey, ICE, come get these folks. Well, I don't know if you or your listeners heard this, but in the allegation in a Texas school, middle school, was that kids were taunting an 11-year-old Latina girl, and so much bullying. That and she ended up taking her life last week, and it's just absolutely devastating. And of course, there's never one single cause for a catastrophe, a nightmare of that story. But the idea that kids are talking to each other that way, that they're gonna impose a kind of a legal violence on someone else essentially changes how everyone in a community acts. If you think that the folks in town are not just loudmouths, but loudmouths that can take essentially can either mobilize the law on their behalf or are deputized to take the law in their own hands, that changes how you participate in public life. It changes whether you cover or cover whether you're LGBT or not. It changes whether you speak up at a public forum or not, because there's the potential for backlash, the potential for challenges and attacks are so great. And if you think that the community powers that be are in league with the kind of social moray for enforcers, well, then you're just not going to go to those meetings, or you're going to sit quietly and nod your head, even if you disagree vehemently. And that changes the entire complexion of our democracy.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, even me with this podcast, when I'm picking the different topics that I have, I think, well, I mean, I want to speak freely and interview people who can speak freely, but sometimes in the back of my head, I'm like, I don't know, this one might be, at least at this stage of this presidency in particular, maybe should wait and sort of see how things go, especially as a journalist, you're, always in flux, it seems.
Yeah, and for folks who have different responsibilities or are, part of a kind of infrastructure that can be that pressure can be brought to bear. If you think about like librarians and teachers have to be already were already pretty careful in especially in red states because there were targeted campaigns, including you could be sued and your district could be sued if you like Florida had this so-called Don't Say Gay law where teachers weren't supposed to talk about gender and sexual orientation. And some states have, Tennessee in particular, about kind of transgender equity laws. And so allowing transgender girls to play on sports teams, to allow them to use the bathrooms that match their gender identity, again, could financially ruin a school district.
Yeah,
So
that's
what are you
true.
going to do in those situations? Same thing now, they have like big library book bans in those states. And there's some photos in the Washington Post had run a story. And essentially what districts in Florida did was close down entire sections of their libraries
Right, they had like
preemptively.
nothing on the shelves, right? That
They just closed it down. And so even without a single case of enforcement, the threat of losing a lawsuit is so great that you just abandon the enterprise altogether.
Wow, that's powerful in a not so great way,
It's
you know.
powerful and it feeds upon itself because the more power the movement gets, the more they'll say, well, what else can we get away with? Who else is left? We conquer, we solve that problem. What are we going to next? And I think one of the scary parts is so David and I start off the Vigilante Nation book talking about all these red state kind of say strategies for essentially allowing individuals and groups to engage in anti-democratic practices. The starting point was, oh wow, the direct type of attacks failed, namely January 6th. So after January 6th, the insurrection was put down, the prosecution started up, and they persisted throughout the entirety of the Biden administration. And so it seemed like, okay, well, direct action against cops is off the table. So let's do all these other things. But now that those insurrectionists have been pardoned,
Unconditionally.
we have a situation where we don't have to necessarily do kind of like more covert, subtle, subterranean tricks to accomplish things because the president has essentially endorsed a very powerful form of essentially direct assaults on the basis of a claim that we think what's going on inside that building, the Capitol, is unlawful. Right. And so, how is that different from any other type of group that says, well, we think what's going inside of that building is no good? What's going on inside a hospital? What's going on inside of a university? Right. And we're seeing that again when we talk about how these things gravitate to the left. We're seeing, campaigns of harassment that are targeting the Jewish American community because there are claims that what they're up to is no good. And it's often framed around, complicity with, alleged complicity with alleged, human rights violations overseas, or maybe it's not. Maybe it's just campaigns of targeted harassment. But so we see this idea that your view of the world is enough to act upon. And it's bad enough when people do that on their own, because it causes problems even then, and the state's like, okay, well, we gotta crack down on this. But if the state encourages it, or on some places, if there were credible claims or beliefs that the police aren't going to do anything about it, or can't do anything about it, or the universities aren't going to do anything about it, and I'm not saying the universities aren't doing anything, But if we get to a point, or in some campuses it works out that way, well, then we have a problem gravitating to the left.
So it's not just, it seems like right now it seems to be more right wing, but that doesn't mean it hasn't ever, been to the left
Well,
as
so it
well
hasn't been to the left in terms of
in
a
a while, at least.
United States endorsed project. But that doesn't mean it can't be. It doesn't, there's nothing, there might be, as folks smarter and more well-read than I am, or better read than I am, would say that, there are traits that the far left and the far right tend to share in when they go to real extremist position. The difference is we've not really had any far left people ever in power in the United States, where we've had plenty of times in which far right leaders, hardcore segregationists, have been in power. So so even if we see similar things happening in society, for it to become a kind of state-sponsored form of vigilantism under the definitions that we use, the politics would have to change. And so that's why campus is an interesting place. If a campus is considered like a sovereignty unto itself, well, there's a space where you're more likely to have, left leadership than in any other space in the United States,
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
including blue cities, right? So that's why I would zero in on that if I were looking for it. Yeah.
That makes sense. Stepping back just a little bit, it seems like there's a certain type of person that, gravitates toward being a vigilante. Whether it's state sponsored, like let's say SBA, where, there's an encouragement to turn people in, or outside of that, what do you think is at the root of someone like that? Is it like an inflated sense of justice? Is it a, just cr frustration with the current system? I mean, there's a lot of things that seem to collide.
So I'm not a psychologist. I'm a lawyer. I don't want to
I
get too
gotcha.
far into the psyche, but there is a the patterns of folks who are particularly interested in this have a sense of they've been aggrieved. Society isn't supporting their adequately supporting their basis of grievance or offense, and they feel sufficiently frustrated that they want to take matters into their own hands. But when you think about state-sponsored vigilantism, the risk level goes down considerably because now you're not taking the chance as much. You're
Yeah,
not saying,
that's
"Well, I'll
true.
see what happens and I'll take my lumps." Nor are you necessarily so inspired yourself. It's a feedback loop. The state is telling you that this is a problem. The state is encouraging you to address the problem yourself. And often the state could be rewarding you. So SBA, you get paid too.
Yeah, was it $10,000? Is that what it is?
Yeah,
Something
minimum.
like that?
Yeah.
Minimum. Yeah.
Yeah. The
Okay.
bounties are high.
Yeah.
And
Wow.
it's not alone. And that was true with things like the Fugitive Slave Act too, where you could go and go up north. You can send your gang of slavers up north, and they would get paid.
Yeah.
So it's there's a monetary element to it. There's a sense that the state wants you to do it. The state is asking you to do it. So David and I have this quote that we found when there was some Black Lives Matter march through, I believe, Jacksonville, Florida. I'm not exactly sure.
Oh, that's
And
my
they were
hometown.
blocking traffic, and drivers were frustrated and were getting more and more agitated. And people, counter protesters, were yelling, "Go ahead, crash into them. DeSantis says it's okay." Now, in truth, at that moment, DeSantis hadn't said it, but a month later or 2 months later, Florida did enact a law that allows you as a driver to use your car in quote unquote self-defense, Oklahoma has that
Oh,
law too.
really?
Yes.
Huh.
So
Interesting.
this, but this idea that maybe you wouldn't do it on your own, but R Governor
Yeah.
Ron tells you to do it. So I
Right.
think what we've seen of late is that vigilantes don't necessarily have to be as risk-seeking, risk-takers as
Right.
they might have in the past. And the
Yeah.
demographics of vigilantism is much broader today, depending on the type of engagement. If we're talking about kind of street thuggery, it still, I think, is largely male. But
Yeah.
if we're talking about campaigns to that are concentrated against schools, against healthcare providers, with schools, there's a lot of women involved in those
Yeah.
projects as well. And so we're seeing, that doesn't have the same type of physical conflict, but it has
Right.
the same effect that one is endangered from fully participating in democratic society, which is how we define the kind of vigilantism. It doesn't have to have a physical component to it, as long as
Yeah.
there's the, a credible fear that your life can be significantly diminished by the power that this person or group is exercising over you.
Oh, yeah. I didn't think about that. I always think about the vigilante being physical,
Yeah.
with some violence. But yeah,
Yeah.
that makes sense. I read somewhere, and I can't remember if it's in what state it's in, but that most of the book ban, people who recommend books to be banned, it's like the same 11 people. It might be in
Yeah.
Florida, right? Is it Florida?
I think it's nationwide.
Is it
It's
nationwide?
only,
Okay.
I think there's like 11 people.
Interesting.
And
Huh.
I think out of that 11, six of them have brought like 50% of all the claims or something like that. That's in our book. We didn't do
Okay.
the
Oh,
original research, but that's in our
maybe I did
book. So
read
you
it in
probably saw it
your
there.
book.
And that speaks to a couple of things. One is it doesn't take a large movement to cause a terrifying campaign that changes, again, the way in which schools operate across, dozens of states.
Right. Yeah. Wow.
And so when David and I were writing the book, it was again before the 2024 election.
Right.
And to that point, there hadn't been much evidence that the far right kind of MAGA movement could command a majority nationwide. And so one of our whole points is just like under Jim Crow, it's vigilante, political vigilantism is a way to extend power when you're losing a numbers game demographically.
Oh.
And so how do you hold on to power in red states when the young folks aren't going to be as homophobic, transphobic, racist, whatever?
Right.
Then the older generations, well, you essentially change the mores on the ground. You make families who have LGBT members want to leave. You change the dynamics. You force women who might be very powerful voices of, say, the center left. You change their life circumstances by prohibiting abortions, right? And that puts people in a tough situation, right? What do? They leave, they change their life. Otherwise, they change their life trajectory, whether it means staying in a challenging partnership for financial reasons, or it means you have to forgo college or you have to go to college at night, all of which takes you kind of out of the political,
Yeah.
arena to different extents.
Right.
This is a long-winded way of saying that this
No,
was
you
a powerful way of extending essentially what we were characterizing, prematurely characterizing, as a dying movement.
Interesting.
And then November 2024 comes along. So all your listeners, sorry, should buy the
Yeah.
book because it's the only mistake we made, is that we did
Too
not
early.
anticipate. We did not anticipate that Donald Trump would win with a majority, a clear
Yeah.
majority.
Right.
Like, he's already squandered a lot of his political goodwill. But for the moment, he had it, which suggests that the MAGA movement has the capacity to grow. And we don't see it as only older people voting for Trump. We see
Yeah.
plenty of young people voting for Trump. So all
Yeah.
that's to say is that the Vigilante Project, which I think in some ways helps fading constituencies, fading hierarchies, like the old boys club or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
It ha gives them a longer leash on life.
Yeah,
Lease
that
on
makes
life, sorry,
sense.
lease on life.
Yeah.
But now that's less important, though I think it's still true.
Right.
And it's interesting to question because we don't know what's on, we don't yet know what would make Donald Trump unpopular had he not like threatened to go to war with Denmark over Greenland, had he not threatened to do all, you know, all the tariffs that seem to be going. There's a lot of reasons for people to be nervous about the current state of the administration, apart from, say,
Right.
the pardons of the insurrectionists, the
Right.
incapacitation of the FBI, which is undergoing in
Yeah.
part because the FBI and others were still prosecuting,
Right. Yeah.
MAGA affiliated or presumed transgressors, right? So we
Right.
don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know if that if the what is the cause of Trump's declining numbers. It's obviously a combination of everything. But I did want to say that vigilante is an especially potent tool of a embittered and scared minority that numerical minority that currently has power, but is looking around and realizing that power is not going to last forever.
Yeah, it's interesting. It seems like they really maximized the use of white Christian nationalism, whether that was because they're true believers or it's a voting base, and it's powerful, right? Especially at the root of some of this the state-sponsored vigilantism. It's because there's a moral, a moral kind of impetus for change. Well, this is how it's supposed to be, and this is what I believe, and I'm gonna force you. So I wonder if they can continue that, or if that'll dwindle. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, and so this is a hard question for me because it's clearly that the kind of the transgender rights backlash is popular. The backlash is popular, meaning folks are large numbers of folks who are turning against transgender rights, especially as they apply to children, because there's arguments that are being put forward that parents are doing wrong by their kids, as it were. What's interesting about the MAGA movement and is it's like a shark that has to keep on moving. And where I as a as not someone who identifies with that, would be like, well, they have a winning issue that they just rode they that may have that helped them ride into the White House. Maybe they shouldn't go after like Canada. And maybe they shouldn't do all these other stuff. But I think what I don't fully understand about this is that there's always has to be a grievance. And there always has to be to keep the kind of the base mobilized and supportive, particularly as like our economy is likely gonna crater. And as our social and in and public health and environmental infrastructure is may crumble in the future in the near future with the kind of debasement of the civil service, the appointment of folks like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to run Health and Human Services. Like our quality of life might diminish. And then the question is, well, how do you tell folks that they should be thrilled that their quality of life is diminished, and it's because there's some other danger that they need to be focused on instead of the fact that, like, whoa, Hey, prices are even higher under Donald Trump than they were under Joe Biden. Or,
Right.
you know,
Yeah. Can.
maybe we
Yeah.
shouldn't abandon NATO or this or that.
Right. Yeah. It's how long can they tap into outrage, you
Yeah.
know, as the base, or just, you know, yeah, outrage in the base. How long can that last when, you know, I mean, even here in agricultural California, if people were voting on the price of eggs, which I know is a trope, it's like $12 a dozen, you know, here in Yucaipa. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see.
May I say one more thing about the outrage point, though? So
Yeah,
this even
absolutely.
came up in the Supreme Court arguments over SB 8,
Oh.
because historically the question, when if you have a lawsuit, so you have two neighbors fighting over a piece of land or a cow or anything else, and you're just annoyed. You're
Right.
annoyed because person A is in the right and person B is trying to take advantage of person A. Right?
Right.
It's your person C. Person C runs to court and says, "Your Honor, I want to bring a suit." They're going to say, "You don't have a claim. You may be a witness in a case, but you don't have a claim. You don't have a cause of action. Why? Because you haven't been injured." Now you would say, "Well, it bothers me." And they
Right.
would say that's not legally cognizable, the fact that you're
Right.
distressed. Sorry about that, right? So
Yeah.
we get to that point with SB 8, right? What is your injury? You, a neighbor who looks out the window and is like, "I see that pregnant woman on her way. I heard her say to the cab driver or whatever, 'Take me to Planned Parenthood or wherever.'" Right? What, you're offended by that, you're annoyed by that, you run to court and you want vindication. The American law does not really support that.
Ah, right.
And so Justice Clarence Thomas, of all people, no friend of abortion rights, says, "What is your theory on why this is a cognizable claim?" And the Solicitor General for the state of Texas said, "Well, it's the tort of outrage." And Justice Thomas says, "What's the tort of outrage like? Tell me more about this thing
Right.
that I, a justice since what, 1991, and a
Right.
federal judge since the 1980s, I'm not familiar with that." And he basically said that, you know, people's feelings should be accounted for. Well, wait a second. Now, if people's feelings should be accounted for, then
Oh
we could be
boy.
suing every day. Everything we see is a basis for a lawsuit.
Yeah.
And the idea of behind that is so fundamentally at odds with notions of, and I know I keep on coming back to the concept of democracy, but this is
Well,
all about
it's
democracy because
important. Yeah.
democracy codifies laws. And so your feelings need to be brought into the legislative arena, but not taken into your own hands, whether in a court of law or at the, you know, with a rifle in those hands. Right? So we have a process by which we have regulation, and we
Yeah.
have a set of people who are supposed to carry that out. They're well trained. They're supposed to be neutral. They're not supposed to be friends with either Farmer A or Farmer B in my hypothetical.
Right.
And
Yeah.
we're getting to the point where we want to circumvent all those folks who we've spent 100 years building up that professional infrastructure so that we wouldn't have neighbors going to war with each other all the time. And
Yeah.
then people could coexist more peacefully and be more prosperous because they're not spending their time policing their boundaries, and they can go, you know, open up businesses and do creative things and pursue their passions in life. So it's
Yeah,
a,
it's
to
a,
me, it's a big harm, all of this
yeah.
stuff, not just in terms of like the carnage is there. I don't mean to be minimize carnage and the toxicity and stuff like that, but the
Right.
opportunity cost of turning our
Yeah.
society this way is, it just lowers the ceiling, the trajectory in which we could, you know, fully flourish. And that to me is, it's sad in and of itself.
Yeah, that's a good point because I think, and I think I fall into this too. When you talk about democracy and our process and our criminal justice system, due process, just all of that, I think sometimes it feels, unless you're a lawyer or raised like a by a lawyer like me, it seems sort of like, okay, well, all right, it's not as personal, maybe it should be, but it is not. But when you talk about how you're living, your standard of living and all of that, that's an interesting point. It's not just about, well, this is our democracy and this is how the government runs and all of that. It's also how you can live and function, and I had never thought of it that way.
And I don't mean to be unsympathetic to folks who are like, well, the police don't come to my neighborhood and things like that. It's a hard question, but it also, and it's very frustrating, but it is a political question. Well, why are the police not coming to your neighbor? Now, it doesn't mean the answer is good. It could be that, we're only 8% of the population, so the cops don't care about the voters, the mayor doesn't care about us, so the police chief doesn't care about it, right? I'm not saying that there's always like, oh, just go vote and your life will be transformed. But we live in a society in which we've for a long time tried to abide by democratic principles. And when something fails, when we do that and we still have failures, then we look into like, should there be a civil rights investigation for why this community is systematically ignored, right? Then we would call, like, if it's a local issue, you might call the State Department of Justice or the Federal Department of Justice, what, again, which is why it's important for it to exist. And for them to look in and say, yeah, you know what? There is systemic bias in this, in the way policing is done in this community. So we have not far from a perfect system, but we have even backup democratic constraints in place. If the states are screwing us over, let's appeal to the feds. If the feds are screwing us over, let's have the states do more to help us out, right? We have more layers so we don't have to take up guns ourselves. And that's, I mean, look, that's, for some folks, that says that's where we went wrong. We have so many layers of government, and really what we should do is have more cohesive communities where we can work things out. And we don't need guns. We only need guns when things go terrible. But one of the reasons why things go terrible is because neighbors aren't talking to each other, community isn't talking to each other. And I hear that. I just don't think that's, I don't think blaming the fact that the federal government is has a like a civil rights division is the reason that you and your neighbors are not, BFFs and bowling together or whatever. I just don't buy it. Like we could have both.
You could
We can have both.
coexist,
Right. Well, I mean,
like
right. So the idea that like the government, the intrusiveness of the government displaces authentic relationships among neighbors and coworkers and stuff like that. I don't see it operating that way. This is that you can have cohesion, and then the federal government could say, you know what, things are going really well right now. We don't have to allocate resources in this way. We can target other problems like financial crimes, right? The government has like the FBI, the department, the lawyers in the Department of Justice. There's always more problems that they can work on,
It's
and not
not
because
gonna
they're
end.
creating busy work. It's because there's a lot of reasons. And like right now, if I would be a, I'm not advocating it, but it'd probably be a really good job to like think about like what kind of federal financial crimes might I be able to get away with while the FBI is imploding.
Yeah, I might edit that out, give somebody an idea. Oh, cool. Well, I took away a whole hour of your life with this interview, but I really appreciate it because this was a really intellectual and just in-depth way of looking at this issue beyond, like when I first started out with my research, I was looking at there's a lot of like To Catch a Predator kind of groups that are considered vigilantes and that sort of thing, which is interesting, but I think this goes to the core of it also, a lot better. So I appreciate it very
It's my
much.
pleasure. Yeah, thank you.
I could certainly continue debating and analyzing the pros and cons of vigilante justice, but I think my discussion with professor and author John Michaels was more than adequate, and I hope you enjoyed it. His book, Vigilante Nation, is widely available, and I encourage you to read it. I'm in the process of reading it now, and it is really interesting. The Journalism of Everything podcast is a brand new podcast, so if you like it, please subscribe wherever you are listening to this. I also have a website with bonus material and sources at journalismofeverythingpodcast.com. And I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and if you want to see my face, I'm on YouTube. But really, subscribe. Remember that the easiest thing that you can do is stay informed.